How many of you know what a storm cellar is? Well, most everybody does. We had one growing up when I was a kid. My father had dug one about 50, 75 yards from our house right beside the dirt road because there's a high bank there of red clay. Back at that time, there were no weather alerts. No storm sirens that would let you know that there's inclement weather or severe weather descending on the area. At that time, we depended on looking at the skies, and we'd see maybe in the west a dark cloud in the summertime, and we knew that there was possibility of a storm, looked ominous, and very likely would be hit by a storm. Jesus Christ made the statement to the Pharisees and Sadducees. He said, "Hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky, but you cannot see the signs of the times." The signs of the times. I think we all realize that in the world today, there are dark clouds. I suppose many of you are familiar with the doomsday clock, right? You know, this actually was a clock started, I think, during the time of, all of a sudden I've forgotten his name, the genius that did relativity, Einstein, right. I think that began at that time, but it was continued by a group of scientists. And it's a clock that, in looking at this situation in the world, that they said how close it is to midnight, which would be the worst time for mankind ever. I looked it up just before coming today, and here's the headline that it mentioned, a time of unprecedented danger. It is 90 seconds to midnight. This year, the Science and Security Board of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists moved the hands of the doomsday clock forward largely, though not exclusively, because of the mounting danger of the war in Ukraine. The clock now stands at 90 seconds to midnight, the closest to global catastrophe it has ever been. More and more people are feeling that man's continued existence is in jeopardy. It has become a very popular subject among a different group than it used to be so popular among. This different group is, we might call, the intellectuals. Ones in the past, of course, never gave it much thought. But today we find there are many books, lectures, discussions about this topic. Even HBO has a new series called The Last of Us. But of the 8 billion people on the face of the earth, how many know or even worried about this? Most of mankind have other worries. And they basically are concerned about food, crime, survival, making a living. You know, these dominate the thoughts of most of the people. Are we in the last days? Are we near the end of the world? Are we near the return of Jesus Christ? Today, my purpose statement would be something like this. I'd like to take a look at the perilous times that were prophesied to descend upon the earth, to look at Christ's warnings and promises of hope, and also to cover a number of comments from a popular author, lecture, and to spend some time on the subject of artificial intelligence. This topic, this question has been on the minds of God's people probably ever since Jesus Christ stated in Matthew 24 about the time of the end and the end of the age. So it's probably been on the minds of God's people for the last 1900 years or more. Many of God's people have thought it might happen in their lifetime. It was written about in the 60s and also written about in the 1960s. A possibility, a probability, that's always been a question. And now, I think we feel that it is perhaps more probable than ever. Many of us, I think, feel that way. How is today different than the 60s, when the early disciples thought that the end was imminent? Or how is it different from the 1960s, when 1975 became a focal point of the church? Let's go to Matthew chapter 24. I want to mention that I've copied these scriptures down earlier, so I'll be reading from a copy that I made. Hopefully to save a little bit of time, and I hope I don't get too far ahead of you. You can just jot them down, check them later if you'd like. But here's what Christ said in Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. Matthew 24, 21 and 22. Speaking to his disciples, the apostles, he says, "For then will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until the time, no, nor ever shall be." So he's speaking that the time of the end would be a time of great tribulation, he says here. "And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved." Now, maybe perhaps I could give you a title, because my title is found within these verses. I've entitled the subject today, "Unless Those Days Are Shortened." Unless those days are shortened. So as we read the scriptures, it tells us that circumstances in the world would have to arrive at a point where man had the capacity to destroy themselves. There's so much we want to cover today. I hope we can cover the majority of what I have here. What does the scripture say? Well, I think we understand that saying that conditions will get so bad that the survival of all mankind is at stake. It's interesting that he says, worse than anything that has ever been in human history. Worse than the Holocaust, worse than whatever time you might imagine. You know, the time of Genghis Khan, or whatever time you might dig up in history. The time ahead of us is going to be worse than any of those, Christ said. You know, we could spend a lot of time exploring that point. So he's speaking of the horrible times that will precede the return of Jesus Christ. So we'll look at some of the things that seem to show that we are closer than ever. I ask myself, well, why? Why preach on this? Why is it important? What is it that we need to learn? Without turning to particular scriptures, the Apostle Peter's letters, among the purpose that he gave was to stir up the minds of the people of God. The Apostle Paul several times says it's time to awaken. John warned of apathy that would fall on people at the time of the end. What will it take to get the attention of people and even of God's people? What will it take to motivate us to do and be what we should become? Let's turn back to Genesis chapter 11. In Genesis 11, and this is, of course, after the destruction of the earth by the flood, when things once again became so bad, and if we take that into account, we'd say that, they would be worse than even that time. But it wasn't long after the destruction of mankind that man began to turn further and further away from God. So let's read here in Genesis 11, verses 1 through 6. "Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' And they had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower, whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, a reputation.'" That's what he means by that. "Lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built." And of course, we know that, you know, the tower was used for several things, apparently, to worship the heavens, as well as to thwart anything that God might bring a flood again, that they'd build one so high it wouldn't have to worry about that, has been speculated as well. But it was all for the wrong reasons. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language. And this is what they began to do. Now, nothing they propose to do will be withheld from them. And we know what happened. God changed the languages of different individuals and scattered them to slow them down in the things that they were doing. But let's focus here on one particular verse that is interesting as we look and tie it in with the topic that we're covering today. And that is verse 6. It says, nothing will be held from them. And it says that they propose to do, some have that they imagine to do. There are two things to look at here in this particular verse. God is saying nothing will be restrained in what they want to do. You know, that they'll not be held back. It reminded me of in 2 Thessalonians that there is some restraint for a particular time upon, you know, evil people. And here man will be allowed to do whatever he imagines. And interesting, I think the word imagine is a good word to put in there. Nothing that they propose or imagine to do will be withheld from them. So we've heard the statement, I'm sure you have, that man is only limited by his imagination. Anything he imagines, he can and will do. And we could ask, what does God say about our imagining? Well, in Jeremiah 17:9, it says that, you know, the heart of man is evil or sick. And certainly that is true. I'd like for you to look later. We're not going to turn there right now. But in Psalm 2, verses 1 through 4, and it speaks of the nations being opposed to God. Why do they fight against God or oppose him? Again, this is what will happen at the time of the end, which again reminds me of the statement that there would be many antichrist. Not only one in particular, but there would be many anti or against Christ. And I want to say here, and I'll come back and I'll mention that again later, but everything that's antichrist is not necessarily religious. We tend to think of the antichrist as being involved with false religion. That's not necessarily the case. We learned a new phrase during the pandemic. That new phrase was the new normal. The new normal. Well, what we're going to see here, and scriptures will show that as well, that the new normal that's coming is not just only beginning. I say to you that we're on the threshold of when there will be no normal. Because normal will be constantly changing. I'll use a phrase a lot of us are familiar with called, you ain't seen nothing yet. And that, I think we're going to find is true. It's headed our way. I don't know how soon it'll arrive, or it may be right on the verge of our doorsteps right now. Normalcy is leaving. It's disappearing. Change is speeding up. We can handle changes in products. We can handle changes in cars, electronics, cell phones, but we don't handle so well those which affect our survival. Disease, empty store shelves, terror from crime, and on we could go. Let's go now to Deuteronomy chapter 12. I'm sorry, not Deuteronomy, Daniel chapter 12. Daniel 12. We'll look at two verses here at the last book in last chapter of the book of Daniel. We'll read verse 1 first, and then we'll go to verse 4. It says, at that time, Michael, and Michael is a great angel of God, shall stand up, that great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. This will be the book of life. And speaking of those who are written there, of course, are those who have been converted, have been baptized, who received the gift of God's Holy Spirit. Verse 4, but you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of the end. I want to focus on these next words in Daniel 12 and verse 4. He says, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall increase. So at the time of the end, there are two things that are focused on in this verse. People running to and fro, and the multiplication of knowledge. It's not always, and it's not necessarily good knowledge. It's not necessarily knowledge that will be used to benefit humankind. So think of those two things here briefly as we look at that. One, we'll look at running or wandering, as some have, but running, wandering or running about. And some of that, or maybe most of that, could be in fear. In fear, looking for safety, looking for answers, looking for knowledge. Most of you know that I grew up on the farm. And I've seen farm animals or chickens just out of fear start running. You've heard of a stampede, you know, trying to get away by just aimless flight. Not necessarily going anywhere, but just in fear running. And that happens with, you know, fowl and animals, but it's going to happen with humankind as well. I'd like to just, for a minute here, look at a few items that I've seen in the last few days here, news items, and I'll only read the headlines without comment on them. Here's some of the headlines I've seen in just the last few days. U.S. mass killings on a record pace. I think we could understand and see that's happening. Next, the U.S. leads the world in weather catastrophes. Another one from the AP writer, Associated Press writer, Lindsay Tanner. Study after study says American youth are in crisis, facing unprecedented mental health challenges that are burdening teen girls in particular. Among the most glaring data, a recent Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report showing almost 60% of U.S. girls reported persistent sadness and hopelessness. Another one from the Imprimis put out by Hillsdale College, and it's a whole part of a speech on this, but it shows that our medical profession has been crippled by greed. And that's pharmaceuticals and the research, much of it is on things that haven't been proved to be effective, but they can bring in great profit. Another one, fungal attacks threaten global food supply, say experts. Climate crisis is exacerbating damage caused by crop-destroying fungi, risking global health catastrophe. This is from The Guardian. Now, the last time I gave you in part one, I mentioned a couple of books, and I'd like to just give you a few quotes from those books. The first one I wanted to quote from was this one. I actually brought it today since it's smaller. I could fit in my briefcase. And it's called America's Expiration Date by Cal Thomas. He's a very respected columnist. And, of course, he bases this on that his study of most empires only last about 250 years. He begins with ours, of course, in 1776. And he has a lot of material in here showing that we have, you know, a lot of problems in the United States. I'll only take just a few minutes because of time here, but he gives examples of many past empires showing they all go through the same cycle. Here's the cycles that he shows. He goes to the Persian, you know, many, many other Rome and many, many empires of the past. He said every one of them go through these cycles. It's very interesting when you think about it. Here's the first cycle, the age of pioneers. Then you have the age of conquest, the age of commerce, the age of affluence, the age of intellect, the age of decadence, and then decline and fall. He speaks here of one of the problems of almost all of these empires, that it reaches a time of the devaluing of human life. Devaluing human life. Not only in crime, in leadership, but also in abortions. I thought I'd look up because he mentions a particular number of abortions, you know, that, and he didn't say whether U.S. or the world, but we're in the United States, we're averaging around 1 million abortions per year. You know, that fluctuates going up and down. 1 million per year. Do you know what the number of abortions that the world is averaging? Think of this. The whole world, because there are many that are even more liberal than us when it comes to abortions. The whole world is killing how many unborn babies per year? Could you guess? The answer is 14 million every year. You know how sad. Let me read, and he gives some interesting quotes from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who, you know, is a very well-known writer. He fought the communist regime, but he was invited to speak at Harvard. And once he was a hero in America. Once he spoke at Harvard, he was hated. Because one of the things he says is that we've turned against God. And Harvard didn't want to hear that. And he was no longer a hero. I'd like to read just a little bit here. He talked about how, even in our country, that he talks about family life, how the family is going down. He talked about church attendance is dropping, interest in the church. And let me get my other glasses, the smaller print here. He talked about the moral values of those in the city as opposed to those who grew up in the country. The regression from authentic Christianity to what Notre Dame University sociologist Chris Smith calls the moralistic therapeutic deism, a pseudo-religion that jettisons the doctrines of historical biblical Christianity and replaces them with feeling good, vaguely spiritual nostrums. It's the perfect religion for self-centered consumerism culture, but it's not the authentic Christian faith. And let me read just a few here and I'll move on. But he talks about the unrewarded faith and hope of conservative Christians have placed in Republican politics. Dr. Edward Dobson and I addressed in our 1999 book, Blinded by Might, Why the Religious Right Can't Save America. He says, politicians cannot transform human nature. Our problem as a nation are less economic and political and more moral and spiritual. Let me read, just dropping down here, says, if you accept the prophecies laid out in both the Old and New Testaments are true, then reckoning about which Dreher writes is inevitable, about a dramatic turnaround and desire for millions of us to follow a different path. Trying to slow down the collapse of America through the political system is futile. And whoever you want to think about, politically speaking, they cannot save America. You know, and some people think that if they vote the right person in, then we'll save America. But that he shows that that's wrong. Let me go to the other book that I mentioned, which is called The End of the World is Just the Beginning. And in the introduction to the book, he says, historically speaking, we live in an embarrassment of riches and peace. We do here in the U.S., you know, so far as war is concerned. But there is a simple fact that is overlooked. They are artificial. We've been living at a perfect moment, and it is passing. The world of the past few decades has been the best it will ever be in our lifetime because the world, our world, is breaking apart. And I, you know, this book, I'm almost through with it, but I'll try to summarize just a couple points because I think they tie into something we could identify with. He talks about the world trade made possible the shipping and sale of essentials all over the world, food, oil, and gas from a few sources. So countries didn't have to grow or worry about their own food. They could import it in. And same thing for other resources as well, oil. So, and he speaks that we're coming very quickly to the end of globalism, which made that possible, which made possible nations of trade for acquiring so much of what they needed from other sources. He says that's going to end, requiring more self-sufficiency that the world is not ready for. And he shows that a lot of countries, that they can no longer import oil, then that's going to affect so many things for them. And he shows that most of the countries of the world are vulnerable to that. And so, you know, how much of what we have today depends on others, on other people to supply us, you know, provide for us. How many people in the world depend on others for food, for clothing, for water? You know, once people were more self-sustaining, self-supporting for most all of their needs. Now when those others fail us, we're sunk. When I was pastoring in Kansas City, there were signs that said, a Kansas farmer feeds 75 people in the world. I looked it up this morning, and it is now, it says, one Kansas farmer feeds 155 people in the world. How much of what we need, how much of what you enjoy, did you purchase? How much of what we need to survive depends on ships, trains, trucks? And what must they have to keep running? What happens if Atlanta was cut off from trucks? Think about that. What if you had no electricity, no gas, no water? How self-sufficient are we or you? Well, that's some of the things that he covered in his book. He thinks that some of the world can survive that and work out something better. He says he hopes. Back in 2019, I spoke on evolution at the Feast of Tabernacles in Orange Beach. And I quoted this author who wrote the book called Homo Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. The author was Yuval Noah Harari. I'll just quote a little bit to bring it to your mind. I think a good many of you were there. He said about 13 and a half billion years ago, matter, time, and space came into being in what is known as the Big Bang. You know, that's funny. He went on to say that just 6 million years ago, a single female ape had two daughters. One became the ancestor of all chimpanzees, and the other is our grandmother. Two apes, one from one branch, came humans. You know, that was his book. This man, in spite of what we just read, has a brilliant mind. He sees threats to our survival and believes the solutions of the future is in the hands of mankind. His talks are drawing huge crowds, and he is not alone. He spoke at the World Economic Forum. He spoke to top leaders in politics and industry and banking. And many are coming to realize the seriousness of the state of the world. They realize that our survival is at stake. You'll see this discussed and written about more and more as time goes on. You'll see the advent of more prophets, both religious and secular, jumping on this theme or this topic. This Yuval Harari has written another book. I haven't read either one of them. I've read summaries of them. And this new book is a bestseller, and it's on human survival. I'm trying to remember the title of it. It's 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Harari. I'm not recommending it. You can, you know, look up and read a little bit about it if you'd like. Yeah, I think it'd be a waste of time. But I want to talk about some of the things that he has stated in this book. I think you'll find them very, very interesting. He believes that algorithms will save us, not God. With artificial intelligence, he says you can almost instantly take a problem and research everything written in history and come up with a solution. And several brilliant minds have said that it will give us the answer to any question, to any problem. So I want to give you a little bit here. I've I made some notes about what this book, it's kind of a summary of things that he wrote in the book, and it's quite a lengthy book. So I'm going to take a little time. I don't normally like to read so much, but I think it ties in so well with what many people see our future, and it'll help us to understand that normalcy is disappearing. The world today, boiling, turbulent times ahead. Harari, in his new book, examines some of the world's most urgent issues, including terrorism, fake news, and immigration, and also looks at individual concerns such as humility, reason, mental stability, resilience, and even meditation. The publisher says that the book helps us to grapple with a world that is increasingly hard to comprehend, encouraging us to focus our minds on the essential questions we should be asking ourselves today. He thinks there are three main threats to human civilization. Now, this is what he says. One is nuclear war. Two is climate change or ecological collapse. And third is technological or biological disruption. I'll interject here that Stephen Hawking, again, another brilliant individual, so far as the world is concerned, and certainly a mind that is far above mine. And his last book, Brief Answers to the Big Questions, echoes Harari's concerns and notes the imminent threats such as global warming, nuclear war, artificial intelligence, as well as the mathematical certainty for another large asteroid strike, similar to the one that killed off the dinosaurs. Hawking's suggestion to get into space and colonize other planets, because it's almost inevitable that one of these threats will render the Earth uninhabitable within the next millennium. Harari hopes that 21 lessons will help people to have more clarity and more awareness about what's going on in the world today and what urgent and relevant questions and discussions we need to focus on now as being, as well as choices and consequences Homo sapiens can take for the new directions that humanity is facing. So I'm going to give you a short summary. He has five parts. I'm going to give you the name of each of those, and then we'll look at some things in specifically. He speaks of part one, the technological challenge. Next, the political challenge. Part three, despair and hope. Part four, truth. Part five, resilience. Now, let's look at some of the subtopics here. On your future career prospect, soon, you might not have one. When you grow up, you might not have a job. No remaining human job will ever be safe from the threat of future automation. The revolution of automation and artificial intelligence will make humans redundant from all sorts of fields, from truck drivers to lawyers to accountants to teachers and so on. Once artificial intelligence makes better decisions than us about careers and perhaps even relationships, our concept of humanity and life will have to change. Again, I'm just giving a summary here. On future education. And remember, these are some of the top minds in the world and what is being thought about. He says the now century-old model of production line school education is bankrupt. AI, the ultimate master machine learning algorithms will be able to do everything. Forget teaching kids programming. The best skill you can teach them is reinvention. So what else should we be teaching? Well, how to deal with constant change in the constantly changing world. To survive and flourish in such a world, you will need a lot of mental flexibility and great reserves of emotional balance. And says the chapter, this chapter on education in it, Harari charts the past and future of the education and what we should be doing now to ensure that the quality of education, information, and knowledge is enhanced as opposed to degraded. The advice he gives to a 15-year-old is don't rely on the adults too much. Isn't that shocking? Most of them mean well, but they just don't understand the world. What should you rely on then? Technology? Well, not really. Biotechnology, machine learning, algorithms? No. Should you rely on yourself then? Well, if you know yourself, maybe. But most people don't know themselves and are products of external influences because we're living in an era of hacking humans. If the future of humanity is decided in your absence because you're too busy feeding and clothing your kids, you and they will not be exempt from the consequences. Majority of people are not worrying about the end of the world. They're busy with survival, aren't they? And so, immediate problems of life, fun, relationships. You'll remember Christ said, as in the days of Noah. Maybe we'll come back to that. But let's move on here. Climate change, technological disruption, and bioengineering. Yeah, and this bioengineering is really fascinating what they're thinking about, even linking brains and technology together, even linking several brains together. But we don't have time to get into all that. These are real threats to humanity. We better understand our minds before the algorithms make our minds up for us. The real threat of AI shared by modern Cassandras such as Bill Gates, Elon Musk, Jennifer Doudna, Stephen Hawking, he mentions a number of others, Google and others, as well as Yuval Harari, is that AI with machine learning algorithms can write an algorithm that will help it to become self-conscious like humans and will start writing encrypted software that is beyond human understanding, which already has been happening according to Google, where they don't fully understand how their machine learning is doing what it is doing. A prophetic and quite scary quote from Ospensky's In Search of the Miraculous, a 70-year-old book, comes to mind. When a machine knows itself, it is then no longer a machine, at least not such a machine as it was before. It already begins to be responsible for its actions. If you're thinking, and I know I was, well, if it's a machine, we'll just unplug it. If you're thinking of simplistic preventive solutions to AI taking over the world, such as just unplugging the computer and adding some safeguards, think twice. AI is learning how to lie and deceive like humans, which are key essential qualities in any warfare. So if AI can beat anyone in tactical games such as chess and do it in seconds, and everything else online is connected, what then when artificial intelligence becomes conscious? Will humans lose control of the infrastructure of society, or will AI decide it doesn't need humans at all, like we've been doing with a lot of animal and bird species for a long time? James Susskind, in his new book, Future Politics, Living Together in a World Transformed by Tech, confirms Harari's words about AI is already changing our lives and how it's going to get worse. Profound and, let's see, get worse. It's about to transform the way we live together with consequences for politics that are profound and frightening in equal measure. We're not yet ready intellectually, philosophically, or morally for the world we're creating. For example, the Babylon chatbot had a go at talking about medicine and passing medical exams. He suggests that the power in the future will take three forms: force, scrutiny, and perception control, where what we see and hear will be filtered and managed by AI seamlessly, so we don't even know what's happening. On ownership and data, he who owns the data owns the future. It says by 2100, the richest 1% might own not merely most of the world's wealth, but also most of the world's beauty, creativity, and health. And entire countries and continents might become irrelevant, not to mention classes of people, as suggested in his previous book. And he says it will create a new useless class of people, unemployable in post-work world. Data about people will be the most valuable thing, especially in politics. And here's a real interesting one on humanity, story-making machine. Humans have always lived in the age of post-truth. Post-truth, we're already there. Homo sapiens is a post-truth species whose power depends on creating and believing fictions. Your core identity is a complex illusion created by neural networks. We make decisions through feelings, but these feelings do not amount to any kind of free will. Rather, feelings are biochemical mechanisms, algorithms honed through millions of years of evolution. In other words, we have no authentic self and there's no free will. If people believe in free will and that their thoughts or feelings are part of some kind of spiritual capacity, it will be easier to manipulate them because they won't know that these thoughts and feelings have been produced and manipulated in the first place by some external system. He highlights humans think in stories rather than facts, numbers or equations. Simply the story, the better. Every person, group, or nation has its own tales and myths. And of course, he talks about those myths, one of them being belief in God. On war, human stupidity is a powerful force. On truth, post-truth, and fake news. You know, he talks about if you tell a lie long enough, people believe it. On religions, God now serves the nation rather than us serving God. Despite three main threats to humanity, nuclear war, climate change, and technology, biological disruption, another general threat is, Harari criticized, you know, that religion. On resilience, you know, man must become resilient to what's happening. I won't read any more of this. It's some very interesting points in here, but I don't like to read so much. Let's go to the final one that I wanted to bring up here so far as external things that are happening, and that is artificial intelligence. Many people are praising artificial intelligence. Doctors and nurses say they can diagnose a patient within a few minutes that might have taken them hours to look at their problem and diagnose it. What takes humans 10 years to learn, artificial intelligence can learn in 3 seconds. Machine learning. We now have computers that program themselves. As I said, there are many praising it, but many are warning about it as well as a very serious threat to humans, even to our existence. You might say, well, how could this be a threat to our existence? Let me give you some quotes of some individuals just recently. It's interesting, you're going to see this on the news a whole lot more. You know, I was listening to the news today, and even our vice president is attending, I think, a conference dealing with artificial intelligence. But here's something came out recently. A man widely seen as the godfather of artificial intelligence has quit his job, warning about the growing dangers from developments in the field. Jeffrey Hinton, 75, announced his resignation from Google in a statement in the New York Times, saying he now regretted his work. He told the BBC some of the dangers of A1 chatbots were quite scary. Right now, they're not more intelligent than us, as far as I can tell, but I think they soon may be. In an interview Monday with the New York Times, which is first to report his move, Hinton said he was concerned about A1's potential to eliminate jobs and create a world where many will not be able to know what is true anymore. He also pointed to the stunning pace of advancement far beyond what he and others had anticipated. The pace of AI acceleration has surprised even its creators. It has evolved dramatically since Dr. Hinton built a pioneering image analysis network in 2012. If it gets to be much smarter than us, it will be very good at manipulation because it will have learned that from us, and there are very few examples of more intelligent things being controlled by less intelligent things, Hinton told Tapper on Tuesday. In the article, Dr. Hinton referred to bad actors who would try to use AI for bad things. When asked by the BBC to elaborate on this, he replied, "This is just the kind of worst-case scenario, kind of a nightmare scenario. You can imagine, for example, some bad actor like President Putin decides to give robots the ability to create their own sub-goals." Stephen Hawking, before his death, warned that AI could mean the end of the human race. Even Google boss Sundar Pichai said in a recent interview that even he did not fully understand anything that A1 chatbot Bard did. Make no mistake, we're on a speeding train right now, and the concern is that one day it will start building its own tracks. That's from the BBC News. Hinton is not the only tech leader to speak out with concern over AI. A number of members of the community signed a letter in March calling for artificial intelligence labs to stop the training of the most powerful AI systems for at least 6 months, citing profound risk to society and humanity. But they know they can't stop, because if we stop, other countries are going to continue to develop and they'll have an advantage over us. It's like having a tiger by the tail and you can't turn it loose. You know, that I'm almost through with the quotes here, so I appreciate your patience on those. Some say that, and I've read some say that artificial intelligence is the most important discovery ever in the history of humanity. You know, I see it as the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know, that, and you know, there's some good things, but there's a lot of evil things as well. And I want to say that, so far as artificial intelligence, I know almost nothing about it. I only know very little. And I realize that a little knowledge is dangerous. You know, I do realize that. But I also know that I don't know very much about a rattlesnake. But I do know a rattlesnake is dangerous. And I believe that these things that they're talking about create a lot of danger. Certainly a lot of good, but a potential for great evil. I think it's like the opening of a Pandora's box. In the past, humans did all the programming. Now they're going to be able to program themselves. It says it knows how to program, so it'll figure out ways to get around restrictions we put on it. It'll figure out ways to manipulating people to do what it wants. You probably know that one has already gone rogue. Microsoft, I think, was the developer of a artificial intelligence, and it went rogue, and it started saying bad things, you know, to some people. And it took them a good while to shut it down. And this was, you know, just in the past. Let me say just a few things, one other thing here in closing about artificial intelligence. They will have the capacity to duplicate your image and your voice. It's already been done in the music world. And that's part of the striking, the striking writers of Hollywood. They're saying, you're going to start using this program to write, you know, write programs for TV and movies. And we want to, you know, see that somehow we're protected from that. So it'll be able to duplicate your image and to send messages in your name of any type. It could take your computer and send filth and perversion to other people. It could hack your car's computer. Think of self-driving cars, especially the all-electric. It could start wars. You say, well, we could put in safeguards. If expert techs can get around safeguards, how much more AI? Let's go, well, let me quote to you Micah 4 and verse 5. You know, just as Egypt's gods failed them, so will our gods fail us. You know, the false gods. In Micah 4 and verse 5, it says, for all people will walk in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. All nations of the past have had their gods, false gods. You know, Baal, Astarte, Milcom, so on. You could look at the Greeks, their gods. For us, we could see material, money, medical profession, military, and now technology. So Christ warned of false prophets at the time of the end. And not all those will be religious prophets. God is going to bring to nothing the wisdom of mankind. You can find that in 1 Corinthians 1, 19 and 20. I want to go to Jeremiah 8 and verse 9 now. Jeremiah 8 and verse says, the wise men are ashamed. They're dismayed and taken. Behold, they have rejected the word of the Lord. So what wisdom do they have? And that's, God is going to show that these great minds do not have the answers. Instead of being saviors to mankind, they'll be shown to be fools. Psalm 14:1 says, he that says there's no God is a fool. I want to go now to Leviticus 18. In Leviticus chapter 18. When Israel was brought into the promised land, God said, I threw the other people out to give it to you. Why did he throw them out? Because they became so morally corrupt. They became so morally corrupt. And then he warned Israel, if you do the same thing will happen to you. Let's look at just a few verses here. Leviticus 18, verses 1 through 3. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, speak to the children of Israel, say to them, I am the Lord your God. According to the doings of the land of Egypt, where you dwelt, you shall not do. According to the doings of the land of Canaan, where I am bringing you, you shall not do, nor shall you walk in their ordinances. Let's drop down to verse 21. I'm going to skip. You can read that, but it shows the things that were wrong. You know, the moral and sexual immorality that was going on. Verse 21, you shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire to Molech, nor shall you profane the name of the Lord your God. They were burning their little children as sacrifices. To me, that's the same thing as abortion. And we could say other things similar that are happening as well. Let's look at verse 22. You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. So homosexuality, gay, same-sex marriage, God says is an abomination. Verses 26 through 28. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments. You shall not commit any of these things, abominations, either any of your own nation or any stranger who dwells among you. For all these abominations the men of the land have done who were before you, and thus the land is defiled, lest the land vomit you out also when you defile it, as it vomited out the nations that were before you. So God says, if you do these things, I will spew you out of the land. God has never failed to follow through on his warnings as well as his promises, unless there was or is repentance. God cannot lie. If you want to read these warnings in a great extent, read Leviticus 26, Deuteronomy 28. Just to interject a thought here, Cal Thomas, who wrote this book, said, what would you do if you knew the world would end in 2026? Well, we don't believe it'll end in 2026. We know there's a lot got to happen. But what would we do? What should we do? No, we don't know. Christ said we can't know. But we can know that it's close. In the world today, we know there's so much going on to detract us from the kingdom of God. Paul said that we will be entering perilous times, and we are. But more importantly than physical survival is your spiritual future. Could be at peril. God says, take heed. Satan is still the god of this world, and he's orchestrating things to turn you or us, me, from God, from the body, to take away subtly your zeal, your love of the truth, your passion for God's way of life. We must not let that happen. I know that we'll soon forget what I've covered here today. But reality is headed our way like a whirlwind that will bring it home. Change, a new normal, such as we've never seen, is coming if we're in the last days. We're told to get ready, be ready, Christ said. Not bomb shelters, food caches, weapons, but to be spiritually ready. That is our only hope. I want to cover just two or three scriptures here in closing. Matthew 24, 22 again. Matthew 24, 22. Unless those days are shortened, no flesh will be saved alive physically. But then he goes on to say, but for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. God is going to shorten the days. You know, that's a promise. Let's notice something in Jeremiah 6 and verse 16, and it ties in with what this individual and many others would agree with him. Don't look to religion. Don't look to the old generation. Don't look to your parents. They mean well, but they just don't know. Jeremiah 6 and verse 16. God's prophet Jeremiah made this statement. I think even God inspired it, looking forward to the time that we live in. Thus said the Lord, stand in the way and see and ask for the old paths where the good way is and walk in it. Then you'll find rest for your souls. But they said, we will not walk in it. Notice what he says in Jeremiah 6:16. It's the old truths that never fail. Don't turn away from them. Walk in them. Live by them. You know, the commandments, God's way of life has been around for a long, long time, ever since he created humanity. And it is the good way. And we will find rest for our lives if we will walk in those. Zephaniah 2 and verse 11, I'm going to quote that to you. The Lord will be awesome to them, for he will reduce to nothing all the gods of the earth. People shall worship him, each one from his place, indeed all the shores of the nations. You know, God is going to teach us that nothing we can do will save us, that only Christ, only God has the answers, has the solution. So we must do our part. Interesting, my daughter Valerie teaches a third grade class. She's a substitute teacher. That's what she chose to do instead of full time. But she was talking about some things, and a third grader told her, said to my daughter, you're old school, aren't you? That was kind of an interesting statement. And my daughter said, yes, I am. And of course, she could go on to say, you know, old school has kept me sane. Get me on the right path. It brought me a lot of happiness and wonderful children, a good husband and a way of life and hope. You could go on and on. But it's kind of funny coming from a kid. The kid wasn't being all that, you know, critical, but just an observation anyway. You know, what I've covered, and you might want to read John 12:35 a little later, but it ties in with this. You know, what I've covered may look bleak, but it is and it isn't. Thankfully, we know before these things happen that Christ is going to save us from ourselves. I want to, final scripture, go to Luke 17 and verse 26. And it's a scripture most of you have memorized. But I want to focus on something that it ties in with the final days, with the days of Noah. Let me quote it and then I'll make some comments. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. He's speaking of the days that just before the Son of Man makes his return. It'll be similar to the days of Noah. And we know that in Matthew it says they'll marry and give in marriage and so on. And what one thing that he's saying there is that as it was in the days of Noah, it'll be the same at the time of the end. There are two things I want to bring up. One is that people will go on with their daily lives not knowing the storm clouds that are developing. They won't see the storm clouds. They'll be marrying, giving their daughters in marriage, going on with their life, and so on, until it'll be too late. And that's what happened in the days of Noah. But there's another thing I want to bring out here as well. Not that they aren't focused, not only that they're not focused on serious problems, and avoid reality by fun, parties, and fantasy. But what else in the days of Noah can we tie in here? When things get so bad that God has to destroy. Two things. It says they are corrupted, and other places show that humanity becomes corrupted. Their minds become corrupted. But another thing that's brought out, and it's brought out in other places, not only are we corrupted, but we are corruptors. You know, our leaders are corrupted. But that's bad, but they're worse. They corrupt others as well. And you could say, well, how can you say that? Because our leaders are pushing perversion. And I could tie in a lot of other things as well. Let me conclude by saying this: these points here. I believe that a high percentage of man's problems are connected with the family, with parenting. A lot of things influence and therefore shape us and our children. But the parents can be the greatest of the influencers. So as parents and grandparents, let's fight hard, relentlessly, tirelessly for the minds, the lives, the happiness of our children. If you knew that a sex trafficker was in your neighborhood and was having great success with those children, and you had small children or grandchildren, how would it affect you? What would you do? You'd become very, very protective. But there are thousands, tens of thousands of kidnappers out there dressed in business suits who've already talked with your child. They have the approval of school boards, the justice system, government agencies, and they're kidnapping our children through indoctrination, the acceptance of a perverse lifestyle. And they don't know this. When they're pushing things that are being pushed today, and they may even let you keep your child that they're in the process of taking. So I say, keep teaching, set the right example for them, even if they protest and roll their eyes at you and call you old fogies, or the modern term for it, old school. And help them to be around those who are of like values in the church, the camp, the feast, and so forth. For God's word, His truth, is that anchor, always needed, but much more in the near future.